We are joined here live in our studios once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. We just, as pretty much everyone listening knows, we just had an election that was not a complete disaster from where I sit.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of excited about that.
Voter turnout in King County, first off, was 34%, about one-third. That's typical for a primary in Washington State. And the off-year primaries, when we're not having a presidential election, they usually fall in the high 20s to low 30s. So that's pretty typical, maybe a little bit better than we would have expected.
And I think part of the reason for that is some of the progressive candidates, particularly Tammy Morales and Shama Sawant, had very effective ground games where they were door knocking and registering people in the last couple weeks of the election. And we're seeing that in the late ballot drops where almost all of the progressive candidates, well, they won their districts in districts where they were running, except with the exception of Sean Scott in District 4, the U District. But Jermaine Zahale, Lisa Herbold, Tammy Morales, Shama Sawant, and Andrew Lewis are all widening their lead substantially in the ballot drops over the course of the week after the initial election night, to the point where particularly Lisa Herbold and Tammy Morales are over the critical 50% mark now, mm-hmm. Where they were not on election night. And that will help in terms of fundraising and trying to stave off huge amounts of money being invested in their opponents.
Yeah. Now let's go race by race. The county Proposition 1, the parks levy, is passing with a 70% yes vote, which is a big, big majority there.
Yeah.
King County Council District 2, Germay Zahale, 56% to Larry Gossett's 37%. So it looks like Zahale will be replacing Gossett.
Yeah, and that really is, I think, the biggest
if that holds.
Yeah, that was the biggest surprise of the primary. I thought Gossett would do better than that. Mm-hmm. But it looks like between gentrification in that district and just the outflow of African Americans that were the core base of Larry Gossett's support over the years, and the desire for new representation on the council.
And I think that district also has a lot of immigrants in it as well. So
yes.
Zahale is really appealing a lot to them. And also to residents who feel like Gossett maybe in recent years hasn't been doing a good job representing their interests and want someone to fight back against gentrification and other things like that.
So Gossett's going to have, a rough time in November.
Yeah.
But that's a pretty wide margin to overcome.
Now, the King County Council District 8, Joe McDermott is the incumbent. He got 84% over Michael Robert Nehar, his 11%. So those two will go to the final, but it looks very much like Joe McDermott will be reelected in November.
Yeah, and he didn't really have any serious opposition,
no.
Which is unfortunate.
The Port of Seattle Commissioner, Position 2, Sam Cho, got 31% in a big field, with Grant Degenger coming in with 25% as of recent returns. Preeti Sridhar, who we supported or who we said was the progressive choice in this race, was third with about 18%. Doesn't look like she will catch up to Degenger.
Yeah, and Degenger is a former mayor of Bellevue, very much the business candidate in that race. Mm-hmm. Sam Cho is more progressive. We'll see how they do in November.
Yeah. Port of Seattle Commissioner Position 5, Fred Fellman is the incumbent. He got 72%, and his closest challenger is Garth Jacobson with 20. So, again, looks like that's Fellman's race to win in November. And then we come to the city council.
Yeah. And interestingly, in six of the seven races, we were left with a progressive candidate against a candidate that was endorsed by the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce.
Or another conservative PAC.
Yeah. So it looks very much like that's going to be the theme in November for the council races, is there's going to be an enormous amount of money put in those races by the chamber. That PAC alone, not counting the other conservative PACs, has raised over $1 million already for the primary. And it'll probably, between that and the other conservative PACs, it'll probably top $5 million for the general, which is an insane amount of money for council races.
It's a lot of money, yeah. Just in Shama Sawant's district alone, they're nearing $1 million spent there among all the candidates and the PACs, and that's just for the primary.
Yeah, and it's going to be well over $1 million for the two final candidates by November.
Yeah. Now, in City Council District 1, Lisa Herbold is at 51% as of the latest returns, and Phil Tavel at 32% with 40% voter turnout. That was one of the three districts where the Seattle Chamber of Commerce's PAC spent a ton of money, and rich people for Seattle, spent a ton of money opposing Lisa Herbold, and it just hasn't done enough to get Phil Tavel above even a third of the votes there.
Yeah.
And so that's encouraging, but...
Herbold, in her 4 years on council, has really prioritized constituent service for West Seattle, and I think it's paid off in these returns. Now, normally you would consider an incumbent safe when they get more than 50% in a primary, but she's going to be facing there'll be a larger turnout in November. It does skew younger, more progressive, and more diverse, so that helps the progressives.
However, she's in a more suburban, homeowner district.
She is, and she's going to be facing a fire hose of money, as are the next two districts we'll talk about.
And again, as we already mentioned, having all that money pour in with so many candidates in each race, it isn't quite as effective as it will, potentially be in November.
In her district, there were only three candidates, so it looked more like a typical race in District 1, as opposed to, say, the more than a dozen candidates in District 6. So it's a little different district to district. So she's going to have to continue fighting right on through to November in order to counter all the money that's going to get poured in to support Tavel.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that in 2015 she was outspent 3-1, and she managed to squeak out a win.
Yeah.
So this is a situation she's been in before.
Yeah, so volunteers are going to be a big support for her, additional contributions from people who support her, and of course just getting voters to churn out and vote going to be really important for District 1. In District 2, Tammy Morales is right at 50%, and Mark Solomon, whose candidacy looked like it was going nowhere just 2 or 3 months ago, he came in with 23% with a 37% turnout in that district.
Yeah, and he was another one of the
a big beneficiary
the
of money from
money,
the chamber. Yeah, Ari Hoffman in that race only got just under 12%, which is very encouraging because he was running the far right wing Republican platform.
Yeah. And there were several candidates like that in different districts, and none of them topped 15%. They all got in the 10 to 15 range. So there's some support for them.
With the exception of Ann Davis and Satt.
Yes, we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's encouraging that while they do have some support, and that support is obviously very motivated, you can see that by the fact that their candidates keep dropping in percentage with the late ballots coming in. All their supporters voted early, so they're motivated and they're loud, but they're not enough to get somebody on council generally without some other factors, which we'll talk about with Savard Davidson.
The great thing with District 2 is Morales is at 50%, and she's likely to pick up the voters who supported Chris Peguero, Phyllis Porter, and Omari Tahir Garrett. So, that's about another 14%. And if she picks those up, she's going to be really hard to beat.
Exactly.
So she could win this seat pretty easily.
Six of these districts in which progressives are running against chamber folks, and she is probably in the best position of any of them.
Yeah, which means that the Seattle Chamber of Commerce is making these calculations as well, which means we can expect to see a lot of money going into District 2. So again, Morales is going to benefit from having a lot of volunteers, registering a lot of new voters, and just helping with overall voter turnout in November.
Yeah, she and Sawant probably had the best ground game of anybody running this time.
Yeah, and that's good because they're going to need it, particularly Shama Sawant in District 3. She has 37%. Egan O'Ryan has come in second with 22% as of the latest returns. They had a high of 45% turnout in District 3, and I think District 6 had that as well. That's about 10 points higher than you would ordinarily expect for a primary in August on an off presidential year. So a lot of people turned out to vote, and that was primarily, I think, Sawant's crew just going around door knocking and registering voters and saying, come out and vote.
They had an unprecedented for Seattle number of volunteers doing that. Mm-hmm. And it really has paid off in the late returns.
Yeah. Now, unlike in District 2, there aren't a whole lot of other progressives who ran in District 3 where Shama can expect to win their votes. Pat Murakami, for example, she's not going to get any of her voters.
Yeah, I think they're looking
maybe
at DeWolf.
Maybe Zach DeWolf, maybe a few of Amy Wynn's, but she's not going to get any of Logan Bauer's support. So Watt's really going to have a struggle, I think, when it comes to November. Just like last time she ran, it's going to be a lot of hard work, a lot of volunteers. She's going to need a lot of money to counteract the Chamber of Commerce money that's been poured into supporting Egan O'Brien.
And for any of these candidates, now is the time to volunteer. Now is the time to send donations in where they can, you know, apportion them for the campaign to.
Yeah, they can start planning their ground game, too, if they know how many volunteers they have and planning which neighborhoods to go to and how many people to register, et cetera. So don't wait. If you have a candidate you like, go show up and volunteer. Now, in District 4, Alex Peterson won 41%, and Sean Scott is second with 23%, with a 43% turnout. Again, pretty high in that district for a primary. Peterson, of course, is going to be the candidate to beat, and Scott's going to have an uphill race. He can certainly pick up Emily Myers, 13%, but that just puts him within striking distance. It doesn't guarantee that he's going to be neck and neck with Peterson. And I think Peterson's going to pick up a lot of the other candidates' votes, voters. But again, Scott will have to see if Scott plays a good ground game and he manages to get a lot of new voters, particularly among students.
And remember, students were not in school for the primary.
Exactly. They were at home. So if some of them want to switch their address and vote in Seattle, or if some of them haven't voted at home before and it's their first time to register, he's got a potential pool there of voters who could put him well within striking distance of Alex Peterson.
Yeah, and again, turnout is generally larger in November by about 30%. So all of these candidates who are trailing by, you know, 8, 10, 15 percentage points, they do have a pool they can draw from if they have a good ground game.
Yeah. Now, District 5, I was just talking before the show with Mike and Jav about how, because I'm in District 7, I think we got the best mix of candidates through to the final, and District 5 has the worst. Deborah Juarez is at 45%, and Ann Davison Sattler, the sort of NIMBY neighborhood, say, speak out Seattle person, is at 27% with a 40% turnout in that district.
And I think the probably the main reason that she did much better than the other Speak Out Seattle candidates is the Seattle Times endorsement that she received really legitimized her candidacy in a way that was, let's say, most unfortunate. But it does speak to how the reputation that Juarez has gotten on council for being difficult to work with, that Seattle Times would not endorse the pro-business candidate in that race.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially after the Chamber of Commerce endorsed Juarez. Juarez is under 50%, too, which is something that would tend to make an incumbent worry. So that really points to her vulnerability, I think, particularly within her district. She's beloved by the business community throughout Seattle, particularly, and labor unions, because she backs these big development projects like rebuilding Key Arena and...
the waterfront.
Yeah, and the waterfront development. So... You know, I mean, she's loved by big business, but maybe not so much in her district, even though she does tend to rake in the Benny's small benefits for her district from time to time. Now, in District 6, Dan Strauss is at 34% and Heidi Wills at 21% with a high turnout of 45%.
And a lot of candidates in that race.
Yeah, 13, I think, active candidates in that race. Third place was Sergio Garcia at 14%, and Jay Fothy fell in fourth with 13%. The others were in single digits with 3% and under. So it seems really clear that folks in District 6 had a tough time deciding who to vote for. So I think we saw a lot of name recognition bump those two candidates ahead of the others. Strauss name-checked his boss, Sally Bagshaw, as much as he could at every opportunity. And Heidi Wills, of course, she kept mentioning, oh, yes, I was on the city council before. Remember me, remember me. And I think that's really what helped them.
And without mentioning why she left council.
Yes, why she was voted off the council, yeah. Although Strauss is the primary winner, and he is far more progressive than Heidi Wills, and actually seems like a pretty good candidate. Wills will bring in a lot of PAC money because she's been endorsed by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce and other conservative groups. So it's going to be a hard fight for Dan Strauss in District 6. And we'll just see how that goes.
And then there's District 7.
And then there's District 7, my district.
Where we vote.
where I was thinking everybody in District 7 should have throw a little party, because we have Andrew Lewis got 32%, almost a third, and Jim Pugel 25%. Again, there were a lot of candidates in District 7.
And the worst candidate got third place.
Yeah. We had a 38% turnout, which is almost the lowest. District 2 had the lowest. We had the second lowest. And I think this really is the best result we could have hoped for District 7, with two solid candidates, both with pretty good progressive credentials.
Yeah. And I think District 7 being the district that covers downtown, South Lake Union, et cetera, there are a lot of new voters in that district who weren't there 4 years ago and who may not be civically engaged.
Well, with only 38% turnout, I think there are a lot of people who are unregistered or who haven't transferred their registration yet. So it really leaves it wide open for either Lewis or Pugel to go out there, register people to vote, and get them to turn out for November. Pugel is going to have a lot of money behind him because he's been endorsed by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. But I think among the candidates they endorsed, he's probably the best and most progressive.
Yeah.
He's good on police reform issues. He's good on substance abuse issues. He's good on gun control. He's good on understanding the causes of homelessness, although I don't know that he has a good game plan for solving the homelessness problem. Who does? On the other side is Andrew Lewis, who's got really good progressive credentials behind him. He's a lawyer, so he understands the legal ramifications of various bills. He has experience working with people on the city council.
And both of them understand city government very well.
Very well, yeah.
Which is more than you can say for some of the people on council now.
So I think District 7 got the best lineup, which is kind of ironic, because when Sally Bagshaw said she was retiring and not running for re-election in District 7, I remember thinking, oh, please God, let us get at least one progressive candidate in this race. And here I think we have the best lineup now. So maybe I ought to pray more often.
and I think, you know, the general theme in November is going to be the progressives against the big business money, because that's going to be the dynamic in so many of these races. They're all a little bit different, but that theme is going to run through all of them. And for the progressives, it's really going to be incumbent to get out the ground game and raise money.
Yeah. So now the other election items, the City of Seattle Proposition 1 library levy passed with an overwhelming 76% yes. That's more than three quarters of voters.
Go libraries, go parks.
Yes, and I think that shows the values of Seattle residents. Seattle School District 1, Liza Rankin came in with 41% and Eric Blumhagen 39%. District 3, Chandra Hampson, 57%, and Rebecca Muniz, 24%.
Yeah, and Hampson, I think, was the best candidate there. So.
Yeah, and District 6, Leslie Harris with 54.5%, and Molly Mitchell with 34%.
Yeah, and Harris is an incumbent there, the current president of the school board. So she looks well-positioned to have another term.
Yeah, so that's the election wrap-up.
Yep, and we'll see what happens over the next 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the different PACs have got volunteers in there loading wads of dollar bills into the back of trucks.
I think they pay people to do that.
Yeah, they do.
They certainly pay people to make phone calls, knock on doors, and
I'm envisioning sort of like what Trump was doing with the paper towels in Puerto Rico, only it's money.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on the election?
Nope.
No, let's move on.
All right. Then moving on to one of our current council members making a possible run for the AG's office.
Yeah, and given that the last three state AGs have come from King County, we've had Bob Ferguson, who is probably going to run for governor next year. I don't think he's formally announced yet, but it's widely expected.
I saw a recent speech of his, and it really looked like he was campaigning.
Yes. He was there. He replaced Rob McKenna, who was from Bellevue, and he replaced Christine Gregoire, who was from Seattle. So so King County is really a pipeline to that office, and I think Lorena Gonzalez, who has a lot of establishment credentials, is well-positioned to do that. If she actually wins next year, that would open up an at-large position for probably a special election, maybe an interim council member. But it's going to be another opportunity for big business to get somebody in there that's more consistently to their liking. And, you know, if that's done through an election, it's going to be a citywide race, which is going to be even more difficult for somebody else to challenge that candidate and raise money. Mm-hmm. So that may be flipping another council seat toward a more business-oriented
candidate.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah. But if she does not win next year, she's up for re-election in 2021. So she would stay on council if she mm-hmm. doesn't win.
Yeah, she is not planning to give up her council position to campaign. She said she'll do the two at the same time. So
And why should she? I mean, she's got a free shot, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, moving on. Some pushback on Durkin's plan for...
Yeah, the Community Police Commission rejected Durkin's proposal on police accountability reform measures to change the disciplinary process.
Unanimously.
Yeah, unanimously. Now, back in May, U.S. District Court Judge James Robart ruled that the city of Seattle is partially out of compliance with the police reform process because the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract keeps in place a disciplinary process that's largely unchanged. Now, Robart ruled that the city needed to consult with the Department of Justice, the Court Monitor, and the Community Police Commission to come up with a plan that would bring the city back into compliance. So instead of requesting that the Seattle Police Officers Guild reopen the negotiations on the contract, the mayor hired an outside consulting firm composed of several former police chiefs and one police union rep to come up with a plan. Now, on July 29th, that consulting firm sent a draft of that plan to the DOJ, the Court Monitor, and the Community Police Commission. This week, the Community Police Commission rejected that plan unanimously.
And it's important to mm-hmm. note, Durkin clearly does not care at all what the CPC thinks.
Yeah.
But Judge Robart very much does, because they're one of the named stakeholders.
He essentially sided with them in his criticisms of the SPOG contract. So here's what that plan that the consulting firm came up with would do. It would undertake, they're suggesting that the city undertake a survey of the police accountability and disciplinary processes in 20 other U.S. cities and evaluate them on almost 20 different aspects, then follow up with 2 to 3 visits to each city based on whether those cities, quote, utilize successful or promising accountability practices related to discipline appeals processes to gain a deeper understanding of the appeals process in establishing benchmarks for the subsequent analysis, blah, blah, blah.
That sounds, number one, like a heck of a lot of taxpayer money going to a consulting firm. And
yes.
Number two, like a very nice way to delay any rollback of reform.
It's going to take a long time.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
And the third step that they suggested was to conduct an analysis of Seattle's current accountability process to determine if it results in, quote, levels of accountability that ensure constitutional policing, end quote. And there's the problem.
I could swear
because
there was a
the
blue
judge.
I could swear there's a blue ribbon commission in there somewhere.
Yeah. No, there's a problem there because the judge has already ruled that the Seattle's current police accountability process does not ensure constitutional policing. So for Durkin to hire a consulting firm to come in and try to do the opposite is exactly what I pointed out when she said that she had hired this firm. I said, you know, she's hiring the firm in order to try to persuade the judge that his original ruling here was wrong.
Yeah.
And to change his ruling.
And doing that by comparing Seattle's police reform process with police reform in other cities and saying, well, Seattle's being held to a much higher standard, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So they're suggesting, so this consulting firm is suggesting literally that Seattle start over from scratch and ignore 5 years of work that's already been done on police reform when it comes to the disciplinary process. What I found most irritating about this plan, again, is that it ignores Judge Robart's ruling. And that we know that there's something wrong with the disciplinary process. We don't need to spend months and months and months comparing our unconstitutional system to other cities' systems, which might be slightly better or in some cases quite worse. And that's the same point that the CPC made this week when they rejected the plan. They said, quote, other cities may have some or none of those essential elements, but equivalency to other cities is not the metric to which the court or community aspire. Indeed, one of the observations which drove the CPC's recommendations on accountability reform in 2014 was that no jurisdiction nationally had arrived at a set of best practices that deliver public legitimacy and satisfaction on accountability. Seattle needed to do better. So the CPC is suggesting, literally, that Seattle can be a leader in police reform if the mayor can get off her butt and look for ways to fix the SPOG contract.
And if the mayor weren't committed to trying to uphold some of the worst practices that SPOG is really married to.
Yeah. Now, the CPC had some suggestions for Mayor Durkan as to how she could fix the SPOG contract.
I'll bet they had some suggestions for her, too.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. But I thought these were good suggestions. First one, instead of reopening the contract, the mayor could set, which could set a bad precedent for other labor contracts negotiated with the city, the mayor could negotiate a memorandum of agreement with SPOG to clarify the interpretation of various clauses in the contract that relate to the disciplinary process, and that could become part of a new contract negotiated for 2021. Now, the mayor could, and the CPC says that she should, exercise the portions of the SPOG contract that allow it to be reopened, because there are some pieces of the contract that say this contract can be reopened if. The mayor should exercise those portions. The CPC also said that the mayor should formally ask SPOG to extend that list of reopeners to additional items, then confirm to the court that she's actually done that, ask them to do that. Now, they also said the mayor should immediately start negotiating the next SPOG contract, which would start in 2021 and is going to have to be, the negotiations for that are going to have to be started soon anyway. And that as part of that process, they can talk more firmly about the disciplinary process and maybe come up with something that the judge will approve.
Yeah, and SPOG itself has said they are not open to renegotiating that contract.
I know they have, yeah, but the mayor has not formally asked them.
No, she has not.
And that's a problem. Now, I would also add this. The mayor should probably ask for clarification and guidance from Judge Robart as to which portions of the disciplinary process are unconstitutional specifically. And specifically when it comes to the arbitration process. Now, state law says that public union members have the right to arbitration. So, like, public union members being city employees, firefighters union, police union, et cetera. But if Robart rules that arbitration itself is unconstitutional when it comes to police officers, then the city has a stronger bargaining position with SPOG and can demand that arbitration be dropped without fear that SPOG will sue them in state court. On the other hand, if Robart refuses to rule against arbitration, then the city knows that they're going to have to focus on changing the way the arbitration is done in the SPOG contract, and that then may calm some fears that the union has, the Seattle Police Officers Guild has, that the city will try to take away arbitration altogether.
Yeah, those are very sensible recommendations. Mm-hmm. I don't have any confidence at all that Durkan is
that Durkan will do it. Yeah, I know. So, and I just want to say that the judge did not say that the city had to change the SPOG contract to comply completely with the police reform law that the city council passed last year, although that law did do away with the arbitration option in favor of a public safety civil service commission, which would be an independent body that can hear disciplinary cases and appeals and make final rulings. A lot of folks who look at police reform issues say that that's a really good idea and a really good process. Maybe that can be changed a little bit to satisfy the SPOG's desire to still include arbitration.
Yeah, and they're really wed to it because in the current system, it's colleagues who are ruling on the arbitration.
Yeah.
People in law enforcement.
They can pick and choose. So yes. They can go outside of people who know anything about law enforcement to find an arbitrator that they think might be sympathetic to them and who they can kind of inform that person of what standard practice is.
Right.
Yeah.
Or what their interpretation of standard practice is.
And that's been an issue. And a Public Safety Civil Service Commission would be staffed by people who do know what standard practice is and do know what the standards should be. And that would, I think, be more professional and be a much better process.
All right. Well, one last item for the city, and Mayor had a big to-do this week about sale of the Mercer Mega Block.
Yeah, Mayor Durkan announced the sale of a 3-acre lot of city land in South Lake Union on Mercer Street between Aurora and 9th Avenue, known as the Mercer Mega Block. Activists have been urging her to keep that land in public hands and develop it for affordable housing instead. Now, the main objection that Durkin's representative raised to that very idea is that the city didn't have the money to build affordable housing on that site, and they didn't know how to raise the money. Well, all I can say to that is that that's what the head tax was supposed to be for.
Absolutely.
What the mayor didn't tell us was that the city had already borrowed $29 million against the sale of the Mercer Mega Block, including some debt left over from the purchase of that land. The city originally bought the land to use as a staging area for equipment during the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project, which made Mercer a two-way street and added to traffic congestion in South Lake Union and Lower Queen Anne.
But it improved property values fabulously.
Oh, it certainly did. Also, the value of this Mercer mega block that the city is selling. So the sale is going to bring in $143.5 million, which the city will use as follows. $29.1 million to pay off the debt on that land. And because the land was purchased with revenue from the commercial parking tax and the gas tax, $50 million of the sale proceeds will have to be spent on transportation projects. $42.2 million will go for the city to buy property to build affordable housing in other neighborhoods that are at risk of high displacement. $15 million will go for a loan fund to help nonprofit developers buy land for low-income housing. $6 million will go for a loan program to help low-income homeowners build accessory dwelling units, that's basement apartments or backyard cottages, and $5 million will go into homelessness programs. Okay.
The part that jumps out is the big chunk going to transportation projects.
Yeah.
Because the city has a long history of using transportation money for real estate development.
Yeah, to boost property values. Now, the city says it will be getting other amenities from Alexandria Real Estate Equities, which is the purchaser of the land. And that includes 175 affordable housing units built on site for people who make less than 60% of median income. Now, the city gave Alexandria a $38 million price discount in exchange for this amenity. And I did the math. That comes out to $217,143 per unit. To compare, building a 2,000 square foot standalone house in Seattle would cost around $300,000. A tiny house would cost anywhere from $500 to $23,000. And apartment buildings can be built at prices that average between $64,600 to $86,000 per unit. So I don't know why the city settled for only 175 units when they could have gotten more than 400 units by keeping at least a small part of the land and building them themselves. So here's why they decided to sell it all to Alexandria. Alexandria wants to build up to 190 units of market rate housing in the same building as the affordable housing units. In addition, Alexandria will build two much larger commercial buildings that will hold life sciences labs and office space, as well as ground floor retail. So this is going to be enormously profitable for them. And it still would have been profitable, incredibly profitable for them, if the city had kept a piece of that land for housing. But the city did not do that, and it makes me wonder who's scratching whose back here.
Yeah, and now, it'd be interesting to see who Alexandria has donated to over the past couple years.
One of the commercial buildings will hold a 30,000-square-foot community center that the city will operate rent-free for 40 years, after which the city will have to surrender the space or start paying rent. And finally, as part of the street and sidewalk repaving, the developer will extend the Mercer Street bike lane for another 2.5 blocks, which the city is saying, wow, look, we're even getting a bike lane, blah, blah, blah. And I have to say, you know, given the way that these big developments completely redo a streetscape, adding, you know, 2.5 blocks of bike lane is not going to make up for $38 million off the sale price.
And I'm thinking very few people are going to be able to live in those bike lanes.
Yeah. So I think the best way to really view this sale is as a lost opportunity. Now, at least a portion of this site, even a small portion of this site, if the city had kept it and used it to build on, could have been the site of the very first public affordable housing project built with money from the head tax. And, you know, it's a perfect location. South, this Mercer mega block is close to parks, it's close to transit, it's close to retail, it's close to jobs downtown and services for people who need them, who are taking advantage of affordable housing. So the city could have built a school as part of this. They could have brought in a grocery store and other retail for the ground floor to help support the expenses of running public housing.
Not to mention all the new residents in that area.
Yeah, but they did. There was obviously no planning for anything like that. It was not even considered as part of this process. And this is what really bugs me about the affordable housing discussion in Seattle, is year after year we have these mayors who just don't think of this stuff.
Yeah,
just
and,
are not interested.
And who are not prioritizing it.
Yeah, and they're not even talking to developers or nonprofit developers to partner with commercial developers to say, hey, can we get anything even like that?
And, you know, developers in this city get a really good deal compared to other jurisdictions around King County and the Pacific Northwest. There's, there's no taxes that would go toward helping the city defray additional infrastructure costs. The city does not ask developers for a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, the additional infrastructure here is 2.5 blocks of bike lane, essentially. And
woo-hoo.
And Alexandria will clean up some soil contamination at the site,
awesome.
which would have been part of any sale deal for this site.
That's just continuing the bike lane that's already there on Mercer.
That's already
right?
there, yeah, on
so
Mercer. So it's just 2.5.
That was a given anyway.
Yeah, 2.5 additional blocks. Either the city probably would have paid for it or the developer. In this case, the developer's paying for it. And like I say, these big developments remake the entire streetscape in front of them when they do a whole block development like that. So, you know, whether they have a fancy new wide sidewalk or whether they just paint in a new bike lane with some barriers, I mean, it's not going to be a heck of a lot more expensive for them to do a bike lane than it would otherwise.
And they'll have that cash flow from the advanced sale of the condos they're building.
And there's still a lot of details of this we don't know because the contract
The contract has not been released in an unredacted version.
Exactly.
The city has allowed Alexandria to release the contract, but Alexandria has gone ahead and just blacked out whole portions of the contract.
Major portions of it.
Yeah.
And Erica Barnett has inquired about getting the non-redacted version of that. And
since it's a public sale, yeah.
And the city's response is, well, that's going to involve a lawsuit that Alexandria is going to fight. And she, as a reporter, would be on the receiving end of that lawsuit for asking for that information.
Essentially, the city's told her, don't ask because you'll get sued.
Yeah. And we'll take you to the cleaners just in legal fees.
Yeah.
Which is
crazy.
Nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
But it tells you about the Durkin administration's commitment to transparency or lack of it.
Yeah. As well as their lack of commitment to real affordable housing.
Yep.
All right. Well, and a lot of this is still going to be worked out, hopefully, with the new city
council.
And
I think the
city
council will have to approve the sale at some point, too. So
details can still be
worked
out.
Keep stay tuned in.
Yep. We'll keep following it.
All right. All right. So moving on to national last
week. Before we do that, can we mention that this is KODX and you're listening to
Eat
the Airwaves?
Yes.
And we are an all-volunteer station. And we need volunteers and we need money to keep going because that's how we pay the electricity. So if you find this kind of information valuable, send some money our way.
Yeah.
You can do it through the Patreon button, or there's also a PayPal button.
Which a couple people did last week.
On our website,
awesome.
Which is www.kodxseattle.org.
Yep.
KODXseattle.org.
And if you want to do it the old-fashioned way and mail us a check, you make it out to Eat Earth on the Air Independent Media, and it's P.O. Box
45883.
This is Mike's favorite part of the show.
Seattle, Washington.
98145.
All right. Job knows the zip code because he's got a box that's almost near ours.
Yep. Uh-huh. It's true.
From the old days. All right. So last week when we were doing the show, we had all just gotten news of the mass shooting in El Paso. Did you want to touch on that?
Yeah, we know a lot more about it now, including the alleged shooter's motivations. He is a white supremacist who specifically wanted to target Mexicans, which is why he drove 600 miles from suburban Dallas to El Paso.
In his manifesto, he used the same wording that is now a Republican talking point, the invasion of the United States from by Hispanic people.
Yeah, and that's been around for a number of years.
It's not new to Donald Trump. It's
been a talking point of the
Republicans since the 90s.
Yeah, I heard that from Limbaugh a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. But but Trump has certainly popularized it. He's made that kind of reference many hundreds of times.
And apparently many of his ads on Facebook, over $1 million spent on over 2,000 ads that reference the invasion of the United States by folks from Mexico.
Yeah,
and
Central America. We found that out through a New York Times article this week. And the White House in response said, sure, we're going to keep doing that all the way through the 2020 election. Why wouldn't we? Which you
this
know,
is, why.
Is a rhetorical question and from their viewpoint, but it does have a number of answers. Mm-hmm. So Trump himself came under a lot of criticism this week for the similarity between the shooter's rant and his wording in his public communications and tweets and so forth. But he certainly is not responsive to changing any of that. And there's been a lot of pressure on Republican lawmakers to distance them from Trump's rhetoric. And so far, none of them have, very few of them have come out and been at all critical of that kind of language either, which is very disturbing. We saw a couple of arrests of potential copycats this week, one outside an immigrant community center in El Paso, waiting with a gun and a knife. He was arrested, or at least detained. And then yesterday, we found out that a white supremacist in Las Vegas was arrested with bomb-making materials and an unregistered firearm with plans to target synagogues and LGBTQ bars. And, this sort of thing has become the new normal, unfortunately, under Donald Trump, the rise in hate crimes consistently from year to year throughout his presidency. It really has taken on a life of its own, and it's something that needs to be resisted here in the Northwest and around the country.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, and there was also the raids in Mississippi that we should talk about.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. On Wednesday, ICE carried out an unprecedented series of raids of 6 chicken processing plants in different parts of Mississippi. And basically rounded up anybody who looked Hispanic. They made no plans for dealing with the kids of those immigrants who were at school at the time on their first day of school and came home or were left stranded at school with nobody to pick them up. And so social service agencies in Mississippi were scrambling to try and deal with all these kids who were terrorized because their moms and dads weren't there.
And the social service agencies criticized ICE, saying no one had contacted them ahead of time to let them know that this might be happening.
As did a number of elected officials in Mississippi, which, of course, mm-hmm. is a predominantly Republican state. So it really was a human rights catastrophe. And as it turns out, some 300 of those nearly 700 people that were arrested were actually detained by ICE. The rest of them were American citizens.
Were released, yeah.
Which tells you that ICE didn't really have any...
Either American citizens or they had work permits or they were asylum process.
Yeah, or they were here legally. Yeah, so it tells you that ICE didn't really have any clear idea of who they were targeting. They just picked up anybody who looked like they might be an immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Now, they also targeted chicken plants that were held as private companies. They did not target any of the very large publicly owned companies that process chicken in Mississippi. Some folks later surmised that could be because the Trump administration wanted to avoid pressure from big Republican donors and shareholders of those publicly owned companies.
Although I was amused that ICE itself put out a statement in response to the brouhaha over all this, saying that they did not tell the White House in advance of these raids because they were afraid that Donald Trump would tweet out the details of it. He's apparently they've had to cancel several previous plans for raids like this because Trump leaked them in ahead of time, which tells you how disciplined he is, that he's so eager to take credit for all this. And there was also an attempt for a similar raid at a homeless shelter in New York City earlier in the week that was stymied because the ICE agents that came did not have a warrant and they were refused entry. So ICE is not well prepared for these raids. They're clearly under some pressure to get them done because Trump has been making promises for a couple of months now that there would be large-scale ICE raids, and ICE just isn't very well organized to carry them out, let alone deal with the people that they detain as a result.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about, I've been evaluating the presidential candidates based on different policies and different issues. This week it's immigration. I wanted to talk a little bit about immigration because what makes immigration so important right now is the increased number of families trying to enter the U.S. with asylum claims and the complete incompetence of the Trump administration bordering on willful abuse of undocumented immigrants.
Oh, it is willful abuse. Mm-hmm. The cruelty is the point.
Yes. And so I wanted to talk about what the Democratic candidates bring to the main Democratic candidates who have all gotten, the ones that have gotten more than 2% in the polls, bring to the table when it comes to their immigration plans. Joe Biden, who is top of the polls still, he sort of comes out to me, turns out to me to be the sensible Republican alternative plan. Biden's website has no specific immigration plan, just a single paragraph with some vague statements, including his record under the Obama administration. But I just want to remind people that the Obama administration ramped up deportations, with many of those people deported for minor offenses like unpaid parking tickets and jaywalking. And the Obama administration only stopped jailing families with children after lawsuits led to the Flores Agreement, which told them that they could only hold them for a limited period of time.
That agreement is, as the Trump administration has been in repeated violation of.
Yes, a continuous violation of the Flores Agreement. Now, during the debates, Biden has specifically said that he would keep in place criminal prosecution of immigrants crossing the border without authorization versus treating it simply as a civil offense. And he would continue to jail and deport people for criminal offenses, even minor ones. Now, he wrote an editorial. I searched and searched for more evidence of what might be termed a recent immigration policy for him. He wrote an editorial in the Miami Herald in June that lays out a few things that he would do if he is elected. He says he would work with Congress to get the DREAM Act passed to create a path to citizenship for young immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, people in the DACA program. And that's a little under a million.
And that's pretty standard fare for all the Democratic candidates.
Yeah, and he would streamline and strengthen the asylum system, quote, so that it benefits legitimate claims of those fleeing persecution while reducing potential for abuse, end quote. And that sounds very much like something a Republican could say, even a Republican in the White House. He says in his editorial that he would like to secure our borders by, quote, improving screening procedures at our legal ports of entry and making smart investments in border technology. That's the position of conservative Democrats when they're asked, would you support a border wall? This is what they say instead. And then finally, he says in his editorial, he would address the root cause of migration in Central America by reducing inequality and expanding economic opportunity in Central America. And then he goes on to criticize Trump's foreign policy with Venezuela, Mexico, and the rest of Latin America, et cetera, et cetera. So he sounds very much like either a very conservative Democrat or a mainstream Republican.
Yeah, and restoring the human services aid to the northern Central American countries that Trump has cut them off from is also standard Democratic fare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he doesn't specifically say that he would restore that aid. He just says he would address the economic. And that can mean anything.
It's
very vague statements. And Biden has not addressed most of the immigration issues that other Democrats have embraced. Now, number two on my list is Elizabeth Warren, not Bernie Sanders this time, because Warren has moved up in the polls, in a lot of the big polls, nationwide polls that I've looked at. So she's number two on my list now. I call her plan the detailed Democratic plan. She would issue an executive order to not enforce criminal law against undocumented immigrants. Now, Julian Castro has said that he would plan to repeal Section 1325 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which criminalizes people crossing the border without authorization. Now, he couldn't do that because only Congress could do that. As president, Elizabeth Warren understands that difference, and she says that she would issue an executive order to tell ICE, the Border Patrol, and other law enforcement agencies to not use criminal law, to not enforce that criminal law. Now, Warren would still enforce the civil laws against undocumented immigrants, but no one can be jailed for a civil violation under federal law. So essentially, she's saying the detentions would end. In 2016, over half of all federal criminal prosecutions, or 52% of them, were for immigration violations. Okay, that's how it's currently being used.
And so that would also mean no more deportations for parking tickets.
Yeah. Now, the other half of federal criminal prosecutions, or 48%, are for real criminal activity, like terrorism, organized crime, hate crimes, and financial fraud. Those are the ones she would concentrate federal criminal prosecutions on, not on immigration violations. Now, she's also said she would end Operation Streamline, which subjects immigrants to mass prosecutions, and because about a third of all immigrants who go through the court process are not represented by lawyers, she would want to end that as well. She would issue guidelines to protect schools, medical facilities, and courthouses from ICE enforcement actions. And she would end the Secure Communities program that forces local police to enforce immigration laws. She would reform the Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, including creating a Department of Justice task force to investigate human rights violations against immigrants within those agencies, including sexual assault, medical neglect, and physical neglect. She would eliminate private detention facilities altogether. She would expand the use of parole and end detention of immigrants except in cases of flight risk or safety risk. So, for example, a murderer who crosses the border. Now, she would remove the immigration courts from the Department of Justice and set them up as an independent court system. She would eliminate expedited removal proceedings and create a public defender corps to provide legal representation to all immigrants, so that she would end those one-third of immigrants who are standing in court without an interpreter, without a lawyer.
And hopefully the small kids being dragged into court also.
Yes, babies sometimes. She would reverse Trump's Muslim ban, et cetera, et cetera. She just has a ton of other things she would do. It's a very, very detailed plan, and I suggest folks go to her website and look at it. Many of these state steps can be taken by a president without requiring Congress to pass laws, but some of them will require more money from the federal budget, and some, like creating new pathways to citizenship, will mean working with Congress to make bigger changes to our immigration system, including passing a comprehensive immigration reform bill, which she also supports. Now, Bernie Sanders, I call his plan the vague statements plan. He would work with Congress to enact comprehensive immigration reform and a pathway to citizenship. And he doesn't mention details. He would expand DACA and the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans programs. He would develop a humane policy for people seeking asylum. He would completely restructure ICE and reform the immigration enforcement system. He would dismantle cruel and inhumane deportation programs and detention centers, including ending family separations, and establish a standard for independent oversight of immigration agencies within the Department of Homeland Security. And that's it. So those sort of vague, general statements, they're far less detailed than Warren's. He has a mixed record on immigration, having voted against and actively worked to kill the 2007 immigration reform bill, arguing, along with several labor unions, that immigration reform would drive down wages for American workers. This is now a Republican talking point, I should mention. For the most part, Sanders has shied away from talking about immigration, sticking with his big overarching statements that are hard to fault, but also really hard to pin him down. Kamala Harris, she's coming out as the aggressive prosecutor. She wants to fight to pass an immigration reform bill with a pathway to citizenship. She wants to reinstate and expand DACA, DAPA, and temporary protected status designations. She wants to close private immigration detention centers and increase oversight of customs and border protection, et cetera, et cetera. She wants to aggressively pursue a foreign policy focused on stabilizing Central America, et cetera, et cetera. So Harris takes the stance of an aggressive lawyer fighting for the rights of immigrants.
Although, to her credit, that's more detailed than many of her other areas.
Oh, yeah. But she has contradicted herself when asked if she would decriminalize undocumented workers, as Elizabeth Warren and Julian Castro would like to do. So we don't really know the answer to that question.
Yeah, she said that in the first round of debates,
and then she walked it back. And then she said it again, and we're not sure if she's walking it back again. So she's not decided on that issue, apparently. Although she has said she would close private immigration detention centers, federal detention centers would still remain open and, I assume, still hold a lot of detainees under Harris. Now, the final candidate who's above 2%, is Pete Buttigieg. He has a national security focus. Immigration, again, is listed under his security policies, which really goes along with his pro-military three-point platform of freedom, security, and democracy. He doesn't list it. Yeah, and he doesn't list it under freedom, and he doesn't list it under democracy, but under security. So that tells you a lot about his stance. He's not looking at immigration from the perspective of the immigrant, but from the perspective of fearful and mostly white American citizens whose instincts are to slam the door on more outsiders coming in to the U.S. Now, he wants to pass an immigration reform bill to include a pathway to citizenship for immigrants, quote, living, working, paying taxes, and contributing to our American story, including Dreamers, end quote. So there are some outs there if he wants to deport people who are, quote unquote, not contributing.
The rhetoric makes me very suspicious.
Yeah, he would put more resources into the lawful immigration system, including the asylum process, to eliminate backlogs, which is good, he's not talking about big structural changes there. He would support, quote, reasonable security measures at the border, end quote. Quote, and that's all he says. He would restore the U.S.'s global leadership in humanitarian relief for refugees, but he makes no mention of lifting the refugee cap as Elizabeth Warren does. She would lift it much higher than Donald Trump has it right now. He would end family separations and, quote, evaluate ICE and border protection practices, not set up an agency to investigate practices or claims and make changes, deep structural changes in ICE and border protection, as Elizabeth Warren has said. And he would, quote, reinstate enforcement priorities, end quote, quote, which I think means deporting immigrants with criminal records. And he would, quote, prevent...
There's a bold statement.
Yeah, and he would, quote, prevent arbitrary targeting of immigrant communities by enforcement officials, end quote, which I think means stop the raids, but I'm not exactly sure. So
maybe stop raids where they have no idea who they're picking up, or they're just picking up anybody with brown skin.
Yeah, so there are no big structural changes here and no real detailed plan, but just a lot of wording to make you think he's got everything under control and it's all under lock and key. So that's Buttigieg for you. So those are the candidates, I said, who are above 2% this week. Unfortunately, Beto O'Rourke is slipping in the polls, and Cory Booker didn't maintain the boost he got in the last debate, so I didn't look at those.
I suspect that Beto O'Rourke will get a bounce because he was very outspoken and very eloquent in response to the El Paso shootings.
Yeah.
And represented his hometown very well.
Yeah, and so I have to say, to wrap this up, of these five candidates, Warren's detailed plan is the best because you know what she's committed to do, and it's a lot. Which is not the case with the others, especially Sanders and Buttigieg and Biden, too. So either some of them have committed to much less, or they've committed to very vague structural change, like Bernie Sanders.
All right. Leaves us all of about a minute, unless you have multiple events.
Yeah, I have a few events.
Okay. Let's go ahead and do those.
Yeah, okay. Today... there's a summer barbecue for democracy. Come hear about the latest wins for electoral reform and campaign finance reform in Washington State, hosted by Fix Democracy First. Tickets are $20. That's from 4 to 7 p.m. at 2021 Northeast 75th Street. Also today is the rally to save the Ave from upzoning and gentrification. That's from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Big Time Brewery and Ale House at 4133 University Way Northeast.
Right down the street.
Mm-hmm. Also,
and they're brewing a special brew just for today.
Just for today, yeah. Also today is the Gun Violence Vigil hosted by March for Our Lives Washington. That's from 7 to 9 p.m. in Occidental Square Park at 117 South Washington Street in Pioneer Square. Tomorrow is the Tisha B'Av, Jews Say Close the Camps. Tisha B'Av is a Jewish day of mourning for the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. This year, several Jewish congregations are holding an immigrant solidarity rally outside of ICE offices in downtown Seattle to resist the Trump administration detention and deportation policies.
And we should give a shout out to the Jewish activists and allies, mm-hmm, who blocked ICE doors earlier this week.
Yeah. So that's going to be at 1 p.m. tomorrow at the Federal Building downtown at 1000 2nd Avenue. That's 2nd and Marion. And then Monday, the Seattle City Council will consider a resolution for a Green New Deal for Seattle. So join Got Green and 350 Seattle to urge the council to pass this resolution. That's from 2 to 5 p.m. on Monday. So that's at 600 4th Avenue at James Street, second floor council chambers.
And I should mention that is a resolution. It's not binding. There's pressure to actually enact some facets of that recommendation, and that pressure should be ongoing.
Yeah, and Tuesday is support the Seattle ordinance to ban super PACs. The Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission will be meeting to consider an ordinance that will ban political action committees from raising unlimited amounts of money and spending it on behalf of their chosen candidates and campaigns. Show up to show your support. That's from 4 to 6 p.m. at 700 Fifth Avenue, Suite 4010.
And
downtown.
That would make the current dynamic in the election cycle, that would ban that.
Very different from what we're seeing
but
this time
around.
I think
it also will get a court challenge that might well succeed.
Yeah, but it's worth on these starting these fights at the local level.
Absolutely.
Because they can work their way up into the federal courts and eventually maybe overturn Citizens United.
Yeah.
Yeah, plenty of things start at the local level.
Yes, they do.
All right. Well, then we will plan on seeing you both back in those seats next week.
Yes.
Unless you change the chairs, yes.
Yes.